It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Obama has announced his intention to keep 8,400 U.S. troops in Afghanistan through the end of his presidency in January to train and advise Afghan forces and combat al-Qaeda and Islamic State extremists. The president said the security situation in Afghanistan remains precarious, requiring a periodic strategy review.
In all these reviews, we're guided by the facts, what's happening on the ground, to determine what's working and what needs to be changed. And that's why at times I've made adjustments, for example, by slowing the drawdown of our forces and more recently by giving U.S. forces more flexibility to support Afghan forces on the ground and in the air. And I strongly believe that it is in our national security interest, especially after all the blood and treasure we've invested in Afghanistan over the years, that we give our Afghan partners the very best opportunity to succeed.
Mr. Obama had initially planned to reduce the number of U.S. troops from the current 9,800 to about 5,500 by the end of this year. U.S. forces have been present in the South Asian country for nearly 15 years following the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks planned in Afghanistan under the then Taliban regime. France on Wednesday sentenced two former Rwandan mayors to life in prison for genocide and crimes against humanity following an 8-week trial in Paris. Tito Barahira and Octavian Ngezi were tried for attacks against ethnic Tutsis in the town of Kabarondo in 1994. Ethnic Hutu extremists killed more than 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus in a 3-month rampage. Some 2,000 people seeking refuge in a church in the town were bludgeoned and hacked to death. Both men consistently denied any wrongdoing. This is VOA News. A 7-year official inquiry into Britain's involvement in the Iraq War concluded Wednesday that intervention led by Prime Minister Tony Blair was unnecessary, and Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein posed no imminent threat to Britain. The inquiry was led by John Chilcutt, a former top British civil servant.
Mr. Blair presented Iraq's past, current, and future capabilities as evidence of the severity of the potential threat from Iraq's WMD. He said that at some point in the future, that threat would become a reality. The judgments about Iraq's capabilities in that statement and in the dossier published the same day were presented with a certainty that was not justified. It is now clear that policy on Iraq was made on the basis of flawed intelligence and assessments. They were not challenged, and they should have been.
Blair said he takes full responsibility for his decision, but insisted he did not mislead the country. There were no lies, no deceit, and no deception. He said he believes the decision was right at the time, and the world is better and safer as a result of it. For the first time, the U.S. put North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, along with 22 others, on the U.S. sanctions list for human rights abuses. John Kirby is a U.S. spokesman.
Human rights abuses in the DPRK are among the worst in the world. The government continues to commit extrajudicial killings, enforced disappearances, arbitrary arrest and detention, forced labor, and torture.
Under the so-called Specially Designated Nationals and Block Persons List, property or interests of those designated within the U.S. jurisdiction will be frozen. Also, transactions by U.S. persons involving the designated persons are generally prohibited. President Obama spoke by phone with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin Wednesday about the situation in Syria and the importance of Russia pressing Damascus for a lasting halt to attacks that often target civilians. They confirmed their commitment to defeating Islamic State and al-Nusra Front, the Syria-based al-Qaeda affiliate. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, en route to Warsaw for NATO's summit, Wednesday stopped in Georgia, signing a security deal to help the former Soviet republic improve its defenses. Mr. Kerry joined Georgian Prime Minister Georgi Kirishvashvili in signing the agreement at a ceremony in Tbilisi.
The United States remains steadfast in our support of Georgia's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Russia's occupation and militarization of parts of Georgia's territory are unacceptable.
The security agreement gives Georgia greater access to U.S. defense equipment, training, and intelligence sharing. Zimbabwe, beset by economic decline, experienced a national job boycott Wednesday. Streets in the capital, Harare, and elsewhere were largely deserted as workers heeded a social media call. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United Nations mission in Liberia touts its security accomplishments.
Things were really not great when we got here in 2003, and I think together with the regional bodies, particularly ECOWAS, we have worked very hard to return stability to Liberia, and this has 100% been achieved.
Valdemar Vray is Deputy Special Representative of the Secretary General for the UN mission in Liberia. Zimbabwe police arrest more people in connection with anti-government protests. Tensions mount as armed groups emerge in central Mali, and the facilitator of Burundian dialogue has postponed the next round of talks.
The government is saying it cannot come there if the CNARED is invited at those talks. And on the other side, the CNARED is saying that if they are not invited as CNARED, they will not be part of the process. So each side seems to be radical on its position.
Inose Mohozi is the general manager of the banned independent Renaissance radio and television network of Burundi. A warning that South Sudan could slide back into yet another civil war, and technological survey countries improve their economies and development. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Deputy Special Representative of the Secretary General for the United Nations mission in Liberia, also known as UNMIL, says the mission has done a good job in bringing security to Liberia during and after its time of conflict. In 2003, the UN Security Council passed Resolution 1509 to, among other responsibilities, protect civilians and assist the Liberian government in developing and implementing its national strategy on security sector reform. The mandate ended on June 30th this year, and UNMIL officially handed over security responsibilities to the Liberian Security. Deputy Special Representative Valdemar Vray says that while UNMIL will no longer have security responsibility, it will, however, maintain a presence in Liberia to support the Liberian government, mostly in capacity building where necessary.
I really think we have accomplished a lot in Liberia. Things were really not great when we got here in 2003. And I think together with the regional bodies, particularly ECOWAS, we have worked very hard to return stability to Liberia. And this has 100% been achieved. It's obviously not only the work of the United Nations. There has been a lot of support and work of the Liberians themselves in this particular area.
So is this a complete handover or partial? Will we still have UNMIL security forces in Liberia?
The responsibility for security has been handed over to the government of Liberia. We will remain present in Liberia under the current mandate that we have. At the request of the UN Security Council, there is going to be a technical review mission that will visit from New York, who will consult with the government, they will consult with us, they will consult with normal citizens of Liberia, and they will consult with the international community, and a final report will be prepared for the Security Council. We are expecting the UN Security Council to then make a decision by the middle of December 2016 of the future footprint and presence of the UN in Liberia. Although we don't have the responsibility for providing security, we will continue to support the government with capacity building where it is possible, and we will await the decision of the UN Security Council.
So I was in Liberia just last week, and every time I passed by the Sprakes Pain Airport area, I saw a group of women wearing white head ties, and I was told that they gather there some days to pray for peace and for UNMIL not to leave Liberia until after the 2017 presidential election because they fear the Liberian security is not ready. Do you feel the Liberian security is really, really ready to take over their responsibility?
You know, it's like a new relationship that has to happen now. The security institutions' capacity have been built. We have seen a large number of them being deployed into the counties. This is now a confidence and a relationship that needs to develop between them and the communities, which will take a bit of time before the population has full confidence in their own institutions. But we need to allow the security institutions now to demonstrate that they have the capacity, and this will automatically create the confidence in the minds of Liberians. So we think that the capacity has been provided, and we are looking forward to see how confident he's going to be built.
Along those lines, did you also receive a petition some time ago from some political parties, an appeal for you not to leave?
Yes, there has been a petition that we have received, and we have reported this to the Secretary General and the UN Security Council. But I think everything will be considered when we have the review team that comes in the second half of this year. We are expecting them around September, and that is when the assessment on the ground will be made for a recommendation to the UN Security Council.
Valdemar Vray is Deputy Special Representative of the Secretary General for the United Nations Mission in Liberia, also known as OMIL. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. The facilitator of Burundian dialogue has postponed the next round of talks that was scheduled to take place from July 9th to the 12th. A tweet by the personal assistant of former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa gave no reason for the postponement and no new date was announced. The conflict in Burundi began last April with President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to seek a controversial third term, something his opponent said violated the constitution. Innocent Muhoozi is general manager of the banned Independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network of Burundi. He says the problem could be that the government's refusal to talk with the main opposition group Sinari and Sinari's insistence to attend the talks as a group, not as individuals.
There's a lot of issues that must find solution before the talks continued. One of the main issues is the people who are going to be part of that process, because the government is saying it cannot come there if the CNARED is invited at those talks. And on the other side, the CNARED is saying that if they are not invited as CNARED, they will not be part of the process. So this is a very difficult issue to sort out, because each side seems to be radical on its position. There is another issue that is very important, which is that at the end of the month of June, the ruling party in Burundi, CNDD-FDD, made clear that they don't want a solution coming from Arusha. They say that Arusha 1 was a kind of battle for cake, and that they don't want to go again for talking about the cake to share this or that. So it's quite clear that there are very important issues that must find solution before we expect that the process can continue.
So it could be, as you are saying, that the both sides are intransigent. They are digging in terms of their positions. So where do we go from here? Is there ever going to be any resolution, political resolution?
Yes, you know, if you remember, when Mwalimu Nyerere was the mediator, and after Mwalimu Nyerere, Mr. Mandela, one thing they used to put pressure on the side that they thought that they should put pressure on. If the mediator today don't put pressure, clear pressure on this side or that side when it's necessary, no one can expect that there are going to be solution without pressure. It's a matter of having the capacity to put pressure on them. You know, Burundi was under an embargo at that period that forced the government to have the negotiations. If today the region don't help the mediator in giving him capacity to put pressure on this side or that side, it's quite clear that there are not going to be answers. So, yes, there are radical positions, but if the head of state of the region want to help the mediator, it's possible to put pressure on both sides and find a solution.
Can we say that with this delay in the talks, that this type of thing benefits President Pierre Nkurunziza, his government?
They might think that it benefits them, but you know, Burundi is in a critical economic situation. And not only that, there are a lot of division inside the ruling party. There are possibilities that war increase. So there is no way, if someone thinks that he can benefit from such kind of situations, it's a big mistake. It's really a big mistake.
Innocent Muhoozi is the general manager of the banned Independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network of Burundi. He was speaking with me from Rwanda's capital, Kigali. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 7th. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Tensions are mounting in cash-trapped Zimbabwe. Civil servants took heed for a call to strike on Wednesday after their wages went unpaid on time for a third time in the past year. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare.
A court released former ZANU-PF official S. Lumumba on $400 bail Wednesday on charges of publicly insulting President Robert Mugabe last week. His lawyer Ashley Mugia said free speech was under attack in Zimbabwe despite it being guaranteed in the country's constitution. He wants the law struck down that protects the 92-year-old Zimbabwean leader from being insulted.
We put the state on notice that on the 15th of July, which is his next remand date, we'll be moving for an application to referral to the Constitutional Court, as we feel that the charge under which he is being charged for is not only competent, but it is also unconstitutional. One of the reasons why the state was opposing bail was essentially that they were blaming the disturbances that are currently dwelling this country on Mr. Lumumba.
For the past week, Zimbabwe has been rocked by protests. More than 100 protesters who were arrested on Monday in Harare will only know of their bail application on Thursday. On Wednesday, Zimbabwe police spokeswoman Charity Charamba told journalists that about 50 people had been arrested in connection with the Shutdown Zimbabwe 2016 campaign, which called for Zimbabweans to stay away from work to push the government to address the current economic meltdown.
Police officers were firmly on the ground and they were in uniform around towns and cities. Obviously, the military is not there because in our assessment for now, the situation is not deteriorated to warrant the presence of the military. If we require the military, we'll call them.
But there were several skirmishes Wednesday that resulted in arrests, which included that of an Australian in the resort town of Victoria Falls, according to Charamba. Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights said it is assisting several protesters arrested in connection with the Shutdown Zimbabwe 2016 campaign. The government issued a statement Wednesday asking Zimbabweans to stop abusing the social media by posting photos or messages about the unrest. Sebastian Mofu, VOA News, Harare.
When it comes to Mali, attention has focused on the conflict in the north. But over the past year, tensions have been climbing in the central part of the country. New armed groups have emerged in the face of continued banditry and disputes over resources. Katarina Hoyer reports for VOA from Duenza in the Mopti region.
In the courtyard of the mayor's office in Kerana, shaded by neem trees, young men sit idle. No one is grazing the cattle anymore out of fear, says Musa Isabari, a herder from this village in Mali's central Mopti region. He says, we're afraid of everyone, mainly the armed bandits and motorbikes that roam the countryside, but also the security forces that arrest you if they find you in the bush because they think you support the rebels. By rebels, he's referring to a broad and ever-evolving spectrum of armed groups that have been emerging around the Mopti region. The most well-known is the Messina Liberation Front, a jihadist movement active since early last year, mainly in central Mali. But criminality and conflict over land and resources are also destabilizing the area. Locals say there's little government presence outside the major urban areas. And pearl traders, herders and village chiefs told VOA that bandits and ethnic militias, some branding themselves as jihadists, have been recruiting young men. Some analysts believe local bandits could just be adopting extremist rhetoric to scare authorities. The mayor of the nearby village of Kerana, Ibrahima Hamadun Bari, called the situation catastrophic. He says people no longer dare to leave the city to go to their fields. At one point, he says, we had at least one deadly attack a week. In some villages, he says, food is becoming a problem because the population don't have access to markets. The situation is even more complicated now than it was a year ago when the Bamako government signed a peace agreement with separatist rebels and other northern armed groups, says Bukari Sangare, a researcher studying the Mopti region since 2008.
Oui, je pense que les conflits se sont aggravés depuis 2015.
He says today the state is absent in several parts of the region where former members of armed groups have moved in. I call these people neo-jihadists because they used to cooperate with Islamists. In June, the UN Security Council voted to beef up the mandate and size of the UN peacekeeping force to Mali amid continued jihadist attacks in the north. Sangare says central Mali should not be ignored.
Quand les pulls basculent, on perdra le nord. Donc, à mon avis,
the center is the umbilical cord that binds the north and south together. If the pearl rises up, you risk losing the north and the center too, Sangare says. Katrina Heye for VOA News in Dwanza, Mali.
A Belgian-based think tank says South Sudan could slide back into a full-scale civil war due to recent outbreaks of deadly violence across the country and the failure of the two former warring parties to fully implement the peace deal signed nearly a year ago. Wake Simon Wudu has the story for VOA from Juba.
In a two-page report released late last week, the International Crisis Group, or ICG, said the honeymoon period for the agreement is now over, adding that the peace agreement is on the verge of collapsing. The International Crisis Group says the fighting is spreading to areas which were initially peaceful. The ICG warns that unless something is done quickly, it's only a matter of time before the government and the SPLM in opposition return to war. The report notes, however, that the permanent ceasefire continues to hold in the major conflict areas of former Upper Nile, Unity, and Jonglei states. The report warns that the increasing number of conflicts in other regions could trigger renewed fighting in Greater Upper Nile or Juba. Government spokesman Michael Makwe dismissed the ICG report, calling it baseless and unfounded.
These are the wishful thinkers who do not believe in peace for South Sudan. These are people who benefit behind crisis. And as such, they would all the time like to give negative reports about whatever happens in any part of the world, not even South Sudan alone.
Deputy spokesman in Riek Machar's office also denied that both the SPLM-IO and SPLM are reluctant to implement the peace agreement. Nyarji Roman admits that disagreements remain between the two parties over security matters.
I think once we implement it, it will reduce the tension between the two groups. That's not only going to help the security forces within the capital, starting from Juba to the other states, to handle the issue of the unknown gunmen.
The ICG says as guarantors to the peace agreement, IGAD should use its authority to reaffirm the party's commitment to the ceasefire and rejection of further violence, as well as resolve differences regarding President Salva Kiir's unilateral decision to expand the number of states from 10 to 28. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
A report by the World Economic Forum says technologically savvy countries are coming out ahead economically and in societal development. This year's Global Information Technology Report says Singapore tops the list of 139 ranked countries, followed by Finland, Sweden, Norway, and the United States. As Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, Burundi and Chad rank at the bottom.
The report finds seven countries, Finland, Switzerland, Sweden, Israel, Singapore, the Netherlands, and the United States, are leading the world in getting the most economic impact from investments in information and communications technologies, or ICT. It says this group of high-achieving economies is doing 33% better than other advanced economies and 100% better than emerging and developing economies. World Economic Forum spokesman Oliver Kahn says consumers, rather than businesses and governments, are driving the digital revolution.
We're finding a very laggard contribution, especially from government, which has stagnated over the past few years. And I'm taking a global view here. There are obviously exceptions. And also business as well. We all think global business is driving ahead, but actually they could be doing a lot more. On the other hand, I think consumer uptake of internet is really far exceeding the contributions and the efforts of government and business.
The report finds Europe remains at the technology frontier, with seven of the top-ranked countries coming from that region. But senior economist and author of the report, Celia Baller, tells VOA there is some very encouraging news coming from parts of the Middle East and sub-Saharan Africa.
There we have some of the largest movers this year. So we see countries like Lebanon making big strides in the index. South Africa is moving up. And Côte d'Ivoire is one of the examples where the government has really been behind the digital agenda, where they're really driving impact. And Ethiopia is another country that we're seeing moving up in the index this year.
Specifically, Bala noted that South Africa has made ICTs more affordable by dropping tariffs on mobile access, while Ivory Coast has strongly improved its business environment. In 2013, it took an average of 32 days to open a new business in Ivory Coast, she says. Today, it takes only 7. The report says the digital divide is widening between rich and poor countries, due in large part to a yawning gap in infrastructure such as high-speed internet. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsoring here is Mark Omer in South Africa. A very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with the basketball. African teams are still struggling to win a match at the Olympic men's basketball qualifiers. Canada pipped Senegal 58-55 in Manila in the Philippines. Croatia outwitted Tunisia 72-52 in Turin, Italy. And hosts Serbia outplayed Angola 83-60 in Belgrade. Senegal are looking for their first victory when they challenge Turkey in Manila today, Thursday. Turning to handball, Angola fell to Norway 23-29. Brazil dismissed Tunisia 37-26 as Romania outclassed Egypt 30-18 at the World Women's Under-20 World Cup in Moscow, Russia on Wednesday. Egypt are in search for their first victory at this event when they challenge Kazakhstan today, Thursday. Turning to athletics, Nigeria's elite athletes based both at home and abroad converge for the 3-day annual Confederation of African Athletics Wari Relays in Sapele, Delta State, South Nigeria, today, Thursday. Besides the Nigerians, several elite athletes from other African countries swing into action to qualify for in their respective Rio de Janeiro Olympic event before the 12th July deadline. The Russia Olympic Committee, ROC, and the International Athletics Federation, IAAF, concluded a specific arbitration agreement to designate the Court of Arbitration for Sports, CAS, the final authority on whether 68 Russian athletes will compete at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. The Court of Arbitration for Sports, CAS, declared in Lausanne, Switzerland. The IAAF suspended the All Russian Athletics Federation from international athletics competition, yet the Russia Olympic Committee and 68 Russian athletes seek to compete at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. CAS will pronounce its ruling on the 21st of July. CAS is the world's highest body in arbitrating sports disputes. Its ruling is binding on all parties concerned. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Eteguini, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good day. And that's it for this Thursday, July 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Mark Woman, along with our engineer Mark Ferguson, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on the Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Yes, sir. Two-Face.
Nato C. Tune in at 200, 300, 1200, and 1300 UTC GMT. Every day, right here on VOA Africa.